This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, June 10th, 2011. In Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer. Coming up on the newscast, outgoing U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates blasts European countries for making the U.S. financially carry NATO's military missions.
The blunt reality is that there will be dwindling appetite and patience in the United States Congress and in the American body politic writ large.
Mexicans calling for an end to the drug war converge on Ciudad Juarez. And the struggle for affordable drugs to treat HIV and AIDS divides rich and poor countries at the United Nations.
The hope is that the resource commitment will be not just from the developed country, but also from developing countries themselves.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Syria, security forces today launched a military operation in the town of Jisr al-Shagur near the border with Turkey. The Guardian says that Syrian troops fired on a human chain trying to block access to the northern town. Refugees continue to cross into Turkey, and the UN has set up a camp along the Turkish border to house them. Al Jazeera reports that 23 people have been killed in the protests today. The agency also posted a video showing men in military uniforms kicking, stomping, and jumping on blindfolded and bound men in civilian clothes. The local coordinating committees for Syria, an activist group monitoring protest activities, say they have confirmed dozens of protests happening across the country. In other Syria news, after nearly a week of controversy, the identity of the blogger, a gay girl in Damascus, is still unknown. Earlier this week, a post stated that the blogger had been abducted by armed men in Syria, but since then, attempts to identify the woman have not been successful, and some information provided on the blog has been proven false. But many caution that just because the true identity of gay girl has not been learned and friends and family have not come forward doesn't mean that a blogger has not been taken into custody. In Syria, homosexuality is illegal, and the use of online pseudonyms and secrecy, even by friends and family, would not be surprising. Officials in South Sudan are accusing the North's Sudanese armed forces of bombing a village along the disputed border between the two. The Sudan People's Liberation Army of the South said it's on high alert for a ground attack from the north. The fighting in the region has displaced 40,000 people, or two-thirds of the residents of the regional capital of Kadugli. Rupert Colville of the UN Human Rights Office says they are receiving reports of civilian casualties.
Roadblocks have been imposed by the fighting forces, preventing medical and humanitarian access. A number of civilians have been killed trying to retrieve food from their homes in the area. And the Kadugli Catholic Church, where a number of internally displaced people sought refuge, was attacked.
The International Organization for Migration says the total number of displaced people in the region is much higher. More than 100,000 fled their homes after fighting began last weekend. In Chicago, late Thursday afternoon, a jury delivered a split verdict to Tahawra Rana, a Pakistan-born Canadian citizen accused of aiding in terrorist activities. FSRN's Kujusa Cesar reports from Chicago.
After the verdict was delivered, prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald told press the jury had split the baby in half. After 2 days of deliberation, the anonymous 12-member panel acquitted Tahawra Rana of the most grave accusation against him. He was found not guilty of using his Chicago-based travel business to help a longtime friend, David Headley, carry out the 2008 terrorist attacks in Mumbai that killed more than 160 people. The jury did find him guilty on two other charges, one, that he materially supported a terrorist organization, and two, that he aided a terrorist plot against a Danish newspaper that published a controversial cartoon of Mohammed. In a twist that could weaken his sentence, the jury determined his aid to the terrorist organization, Lashkar-e-Taiba, did not result in any deaths. Rana's lawyer, Charles Swift, praised the jury for following the evidence on the Mumbai attacks, but said U.S. terrorism sentencing is too harsh in this case.
Had Mr. Rana, for instance, been found guilty of the same thing in Denmark, he'd be looking at 3 to 5 years, where in the United States it's possibly 30. So it's hard for us to be excited about that when our client is potentially facing 30 years for basically buying an airplane ticket.
Swift said he plans to file an appeal. Ketyusa Cesar, FSRN, Chicago.
In Oakland, after 10 days of deliberations, a jury has found Yusuf Bey IV guilty of 3 counts of murder for ordering journalist Chauncey Bailey and 2 other men killed in the summer of 2007. Bey is the leader of the now-defunct Your Black Muslim Bakery. For FSRN, Tina Boschman reports.
Founded some 40 years ago by Bey's father, the bakery promoted self-empowerment and became an institution in Oakland. Prosecutors argued that Yusuf Bey was so desperate to protect the legacy of his family's once influential bakery that he ordered Chauncey Bailey murdered. The Oakland Post editor was set to write a story about the financial problems of Your Black Muslim Bakery as it slid toward bankruptcy. At a press conference, prosecutor Melissa Crum expressed her hope that the verdict sends a message.
The First Amendment is not going to be murdered by murdering journalists. That you cannot kill the man and expect the message to be killed. And that our jury system is not going to stand for murdering of journalists in this country. And they're going to come back with a righteous and just verdict as they did.
Jurors also convicted Bey's co-defendant Antoine Mackey for involvement in the murder plot. Bey and Mackey, who are both 25 years old, could get life in prison without possibility of parole. Sentencing is scheduled for July 8th. Their defense lawyers say they plan to appeal. Tina Boschman, FSRN, Oakland.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Andrew Stelzer in Oakland. In Libya today, fighting intensified near the western city of Misrata. Forces loyal to Colonel Muammar Gaddafi hit rebel targets, killing more than 20 and injuring dozens. An Al Jazeera reporter at the scene described it as complete mayhem after 9 hours of attacks and few facilities to treat the wounded. NATO also continued airstrikes over the last 24 hours, but the more than 20 targets near Misrata and Tripoli did not appear to stop Gaddafi's forces. Some rebel commanders in Misrata pleaded for more air support from NATO, according to The Guardian. As fighting continues in Libya, the Obama administration is continuing to rally support. At a meeting of the Libya Contact Group in the United Arab Emirates, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton applauded NATO's decision to extend the war another 3 months.
We reaffirmed there is only one way forward for Libya. Attacks against civilians must stop. Gaddafi must go. And the Libyan people deserve to determine their own future.
But some countries are starting to limit their involvement. Norway said it would pull out August 1st, and the Netherlands agreed to extend its participation for 3 months but refused to let its fighter jets carry out airstrikes. In meetings this week, outgoing U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates reportedly asked Germany, Poland, Spain, Turkey, and the Netherlands to up their participation in the Libya campaign. Gates, who delivered his last policy speech today in Brussels at the end of an 11-day tour, warned the United States is taking on too large a role in NATO and paying too much of the bill for military operations.
The blunt reality is that there will be dwindling appetite and patience in the United States Congress and in the American body politic writ large to expend increasingly precious funds on behalf of nations that are apparently unwilling to devote the necessary resources or make the necessary changes to be serious and capable partners in their own defense.
Gates said he was impressed by recent changes in Afghanistan and credited NATO nations for doubling their troop presence there since 2006, but he said the mission there has exposed significant political and military shortcomings in NATO, which could similarly come to pass in Libya. Gates leaves his position on June 30th. As FSRN has been following over the past few weeks, a new movement is emerging in Mexico calling for an end to the drug war, which has resulted in the death of more than 40,000 people in the last 4 years. For the past week, a caravan with hundreds of people has been traveling from just outside Mexico City, more than 1,000 miles, to Ciudad Juarez. The Citizens Caravan for Peace with Justice and Dignity is led by poet Javier Cecilia, whose son and 6 of his friends were killed this past March. Journalist Kristen Bricker has been traveling with the caravan, and she joins us now on the phone. Thanks for speaking with us, Kristen.
Thanks for having me.
So the citizens' caravan will be reaching its destination today in Ciudad Juarez, one of the most violent cities in the world, in large part because of the drug war. What's the feeling amongst those participating? Is there any fear? Especially because earlier this week, I know 13 people were killed in a different city only hours before the caravan arrived there.
There's always the possibility that something could happen, especially now that we're in Ciudad Juarez. But I would say that actually there's a lot less fear here in Juarez now today, now that the caravan is here, than there's been in a long time. So we got in actually late last night, and people were lined up along the streets ready to meet us. They were sitting there waiting out in the open. There's a lot of places where people are afraid to go out after dark, but they are coming out to rallies, and they are coming out to marches, and they're dancing in the streets, and they're singing, and they're just very happy that for the first time, even if it's only for a few hours, they can live without fear.
And the plan in Juarez is to sign what they're calling a new social contract. What does that mean?
What it is it's an agreement amongst civil society to push for certain changes in the government and also to push for certain changes in the way society lives. It's about not being isolated and not being locked in your home and scared. It's about getting out, getting to know your neighbors, and working with your neighbors to improve your neighborhood and to improve the country. The pact hasn't been finalized at this point. Right now, there's actually discussions going on in the University of Juarez. But the main points of the pact is the democratization of the media, because a lot of people here believe that because there's just a few media magnates that control the overwhelming majority of the media here, there's just not enough information getting out both about good news that's going on in Mexico and also about movements and dissent against the war, because it's a lot of media has been reporting, you know, that the soldiers being in the towns, it's a good thing, that there's more security, and that's just not the case. We've been meeting people across the most war-torn cities in the country who are saying that when they talk about security in the neighborhoods, they're not talking about organized crime. They're talking about the soldiers and the federal police, and that they are constantly harassing them. The pact also calls for an end to the war on drugs and this law enforcement and particularly militarized strategy.
And what's been the reaction to the caravan of President Felipe Calderon? And I'm also wondering, what about the governors and other officials in the states that the caravan has been passing through?
Felipe Calderon has not really responded to the caravan at this point. And most of the state governments have been rather indifferent. One exception is the state of Nuevo León. When we arrived in Monterrey, Javier Cecilia entered to talk with the state attorney general with several victims' families in Monterrey. These victims' families have been lied to by the state attorney general's office, by the governor. They've promised them that they will carry out an investigation, and then they don't carry out an investigation, or they've even tried to charge them for investigations. This is actually very common, where the government will tell victims' families, we'll carry out an investigation, but we don't have the resources, so you need to pay us so that we investigate. And so Javier Cecilia entered into a private meeting with the attorney general, and he has promised that he will investigate the cases and that he will be in touch with the families. He will actually return their phone calls and meet with them. But since he's made all of his promises before to the families, it remains to be seen at this time if the caravan was enough pressure that he will actually follow through this time.
And what about the role of the U.S., both as part of the problem and the solution? I know there's a contingent of people coming from the states, coming across the border from El Paso, Texas, to meet the caravan in Ciudad Juarez tomorrow.
There has been strong criticism of the role of the United States, but actually, for the most part, the demands have been focused on the Mexican government, in terms of ending corruption and getting the military off of the streets.
Kristen Bricker is a journalist in Mexico. She's currently in Ciudad Juarez along with the Citizens Caravan for Peace with Justice and Dignity. You can find her articles at mywordismyweapon.blogspot.com. Thanks so much for your time, Kristen.
Thank you, Andrea.
At the United Nations high-level meeting on AIDS, world leaders are deciding how to fight the disease in the next decade, but some basic issues are still facing the affected communities. Among them, the waning funds to sustain programs and the availability of cheap drugs to treat HIV and AIDS infections are receiving the most attention. Now, some experts are calling on developing countries like India and China to join richer nations in providing more funds, while others say that international agreements should be respected over smaller-scale trade pacts so that cheaper AIDS drugs can be made available to all. Salim Rizvi has more.
According to the UNAIDS, 34 million people were living with HIV at the end of 2010, and nearly 30 million have died from AIDS-related causes in three decades. Every day, more than 7,000 people are infected with HIV across the globe, and health advocates say more funding is needed to treat millions who lack access to life-saving drugs. Dr. Nafees Sadiq is the UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Asia.
The hope is that the resource commitment will be not just from the developed countries, but also from developing countries themselves, because we need also now to start to think about sustainability of the program.
Many low-income countries still depend heavily on external financing. According to UNAIDS, international donors account for at least 70% of HIV resources in more than 50 countries. In addition to discussions about funding, world leaders meeting in New York are planning an ambitious goal, eliminating new HIV infections in children in 4 years. Nigeria is among the African countries working toward reducing infections and fighting the stigma of the disease. Dr. Adhirami Aziz is the head of HIV/AIDS Strategic Information Unit of Nigeria's Federal Ministry of Health.
The high-risk and vulnerable groups, which are contributing up to 30% of new infection in some parts of Africa. And if we must get to zero new infections, we need to look at this. Then secondly, the area of stigmatization and criminalization of some behaviors. We must know that the issue of gay, the issue of sex workers is a criminal offense in most of African countries. And we need a lot of advocacy so that it will not have a kind of a ripple effect that can make us lose their confidence and also lose whatever we have gained over years.
According to the UN, 79 countries criminalize same-sex relations, 116 countries criminalize some aspect of sex work, and 32 countries permit the death penalty for drug-related offenses. Discrimination is another issue that health advocates are addressing, including in Zambia, where nearly 40% of people with HIV say they have experienced job or income loss. Professor Kumar Babu is the chairman of HIV prevention under the National AIDS Council of Zambia. He says the country is aiming to cut the prevalence of HIV in half by 2015.
We are looking at the vulnerable groups. We are looking at condom promotion. We are looking at male circumcision. We are trying to block cross-border transmission. So we have identified the six drivers of HIV AIDS. We are disseminating this information to all the religious heads, all the chiefs in 74 districts and 9 provinces. So this is not merely in one place. Gradually, you need to go to all stakeholders and win the battle together.
The availability of antiretroviral drugs and treatment for infections have been key to check the spread of HIV/AIDS. More than 6 million people received antiretroviral therapy in low- and middle-income countries at the end of 2010, which is 22 times higher since 2001. Reducing the costs of HIV drugs is critical, but some health advocates say bilateral and regional trade agreements are undermining the ability of developing countries to promote access to cheaper drugs under intellectual property rights. Dr. Nafees Sadiq says international agreements must be respected.
The protection of developing countries, especially for accessibility to drugs, life-saving, etc. Whatever we do in the discussions here, my view is that no bilateral agreement can preempt what has been agreed internationally. You know, because many bilaterals are in fact, even developing countries, are somehow selling away their rights.
While globally the rate of new infections has declined, there has been an increase in Eastern Europe, Middle East and North Africa. According to the latest UNAIDS report, 1.4 million people started life-saving treatment in 2010, which is a yearly record. But for every person starting treatment, two are newly infected. Salim Rizvi, FSRN at the United Nations in New York.
The release this week of almost 100 minority Ahmadiyya Muslims from a Thai immigration detention center marked a major shift in the way asylum seekers and refugees are handled in the country. The refugees, originally from Pakistan, now await visa processing for the United States. As FSRN's Ron Corbin reports, a non-governmental group in Thailand provided a new refugee fund to pay the detainees' bill.
The release of the 96 people from Pakistan's Ahmadiyya Muslim minority brought an end to 6 months of detention at Bangkok's crowded immigration detention center. The group, held for violating Thai visa laws, included 34 children under 12 years of age who were forced to sleep in crowded cells with their mothers. One baby was born during its mother's detention. Anoop Sukumaran, a coordinator with Asia Pacific Refugee Rights Network, says for the women and children, the conditions were grim.
There were times when the cell, especially the women's cell, was so overcrowded that women had to stand so that some of them could sleep, especially those who were pregnant. And this has been because of the overcrowding of the cells in particular.
While individuals can be freed on bail, the group was the first to be released under a new program with the support of Thai civil society. Kitty McKinsey, a regional spokesperson for the UN High Commission for Refugees, says NGOs played a key role in securing the Ahmadiyya group's release.
We really welcome the participation of Thai non-governmental organizations and Thais coming forward to protect refugees and to advocate for refugees.
The breakthrough in the Ahmadiyya release was through a recently launched Refugee Freedom Fund, facilitated by the non-governmental organization Thai Committee for Refugees. The group collected funds from the Ahmadiyya community for a more than $160,000 bond. Iftikhar Ahmed Ayaz, a spokesperson for the Ahmadiyya community, says persecution, threats of violence and death forced the people to flee Pakistan.
In 1974, they declared them to be non-Muslims. And then in 1984, they passed an ordinance to forbid Ahmadis even professing and proclaiming their faith as Muslims. The severity of persecution and the legislation against them, which has resulted, you know, in the prosecution. At the moment, we have about 3,000 Ahmadis in Pakistan, and over 200 Ahmadis have been murdered in Pakistan just because of their faith.
The Ahmadiyya group benefited from having financial support, identifiable travel documents, and agreement by the United States to support their visa applications that enabled Thai immigration authorities to back the program. Remaining behind in the immigration detention cells are 220 Sri Lankan Tamils who had traveled to Thailand with plans to travel to Canada by ship last year. But after one vessel was seized in Canadian waters in August, Canadian authorities pressed Thailand to round up the Tamils. There is also a group of 44 stateless people from Myanmar's Rohingya Muslim community held for the past 2 years. Mr. Sukumaran from Asia Pacific Refugee Rights Network says for the Rohingya, the situation is especially difficult.
The Rohingya issue is particularly complex, precisely because of the fact that they do not have a statehood. As a result, getting them out on bail isn't often a solution which is possible, given the fact that one of the conditions of the bail is a possibility of resettlement.
For the 96 Ahmadiyya, it is a different story. Under grey skies, the men, women and children were led to waiting buses taking them to temporary accommodation.
Yes, sir. Yes, very good day. We are really happy. Thank for immigration, everybody. Thank you.
But officials say the Ahmadiyya still face up to a year for U.S. visa security clearances before they will leave for their new home in America. In the meantime, they are housed in rented apartments away from prison walls. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
A complaint by the National Labor Relations Board against Boeing has been lambasted by conservatives in recent months as an overreach of power. But progressive defenders of the labor board say much more is currently at stake. FSRN's Michael Lawson reports.
The National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB, was founded in 1935 as an independent federal agency to enforce the National Labor Relations Act and safeguard employees' right to organize. During the last 2 years of the Bush administration, the board lacked three of its five members. Since taking office, President Obama appointed two members, both Democratic labor lawyers. Earlier this year, the NLRB filed a complaint against Boeing over the company's decision to build a second line of their 787 Dreamliner in South Carolina. The NLRB says locating the second line of production in South Carolina at a non-union plant was motivated by retaliation for previous strikes at its union plant in Washington State, a violation of labor law. Conservatives from South Carolina and across the country have adamantly spoken out against the complaint. Freshman Republican Jeff Duncan represents South Carolina's 3rd District.
The recent unprecedented action by the National Labor Relations Board is simply the latest example of this administration putting politics before the needs of the American people. Honestly, never thought I'd see the day when our government sued a company over creating jobs in South Carolina or anywhere in the United States.
Boeing and state government officials joined workers at the ribbon-cutting ceremony Friday for the $750 million facility near Charleston. It is considered the largest industrial investment in the state's history. The NLRB has been attacked in conservative media in recent months as being against right-to-work states. Progressive worker organizations see things differently. Kimberly Freeman Brown is executive director of American Rights at Work, a D.C.-based nonprofit advocacy organization. She says the attacks represent a larger attack on the board as an institution.
The other side's strategy is to really misinform the public about the role of the agency and to really discredit it and question its independence. You know, basically what we know that the National Labor Relations Board is doing its job.
House Oversight Committee Chairman Daryl Issa requested documents related to the NLRB's complaint against Boeing and its investigations into union election laws in 4 states. But Caroline Fredrickson with the American Constitution Society says investigation into its actions is like interfering with court proceedings, since the board is an adjudicatory body similar to a federal court.
That you've got a group of Republicans on the Hill who are trying to intimidate the National Labor Relations Board to make a decision based on what they want, rather than doing the job that they were appointed to do, which is to weigh the facts, look at the law, and figure out who is right in the particular case.
The NLRB's acting general counsel, Leif Solomon, issued a statement saying the board's action come as the result of investigations on the ground and are not unprecedented. He will present the board's case at a hearing before an administrative law judge in Seattle on June 14th. Attorneys general from 16 states have authored an amicus brief in support of Boeing. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
And that's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Michael Lawson. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katabshi and Scott Pham. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us at comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.